On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.
Time for our usual hidden history slot with Donald Fallon. Over the years on this slot, we've often talked about the emergency. That's the name that most of us would remember as being given to the Second World War. This year marks an unusual anniversary in the course of Ireland's history with the emergency. It's the 80th anniversary of the arrival of American soldiers into Northern Ireland during World War II. More than 100,000 Americans, who quickly became known as the Yanks, had a strange old time of it in Northern Ireland. Donald Fallon, as I said, is here to bring us up to speed. Donald, even just reading that introduction, 100,000 Americans, in the context of the size of Ulster at the time, that's a huge number.
It's staggering. I think about how difficult it was to move these numbers of men across the world. But by December 1943, there's 120,000 American troops on the ground in Northern Ireland.
That's incredible.
That represents the equivalent of, believe it or not, one-tenth of the total population of Northern Ireland. So one in ten people in Ulster was an American soldier. And when we think of the Second World War, you know, in the context of military history, political history, there's a lot of really interesting social history dimensions to that war too, not least around the experience of American soldiers in Europe.
So not least, of course, the origin of the phrase Americano for a particular style of coffee.
Yes,
because that's where it came from, because they couldn't handle the how intense an espresso was. They needed to add a bit more water to it to dial it down.
And we'll
just
get
one
in,
little legacy.
We'll get into this kind of broader big picture in a moment, but you know, it's worth beginning with just a little anecdote that I think reminds us that this story isn't just about Northern Irish society, you know, and how it got on with the Americans here. It also reminds us this was an interesting time in America's own social history. You know, these young men who wore the same uniform could be very, very divided. And Brian Dooley wrote a beautiful book years ago on Black America's relationship with Ireland. He found this really interesting bit of oral history from someone in Derry who remembered the Second World War years. I remember in the Corinthian dance hall one night, a load of black soldiers came in and a bunch of white Americans. All the black Americans got on one side of the hall and all the white Americans got on the other. And they began advancing towards each other. Some of them grabbed chairs and it looked like an ugly scene. The manager phoned for the shore patrols, and then in came a swarm of military policemen with their batons and began beating everyone. That sort of thing didn't go on. That sort of thing did go on quite regularly in certain dance halls. Isn't that extraordinary?
That's mad.
So the tensions
these guys have
within...
have come to the other side of the world to fight together against a common enemy, and then when they're given time themselves, that basically all they end up doing is round with each other.
Absolutely. The tensions within American society, not just Northern Irish society, are part of this story today.
How much was all of this affected, and even the American arrival into Northern Ireland, how much of it was affected by America arriving late into that World War?
Yeah, and America, history recalls, entered both World Wars considerably late in the day, and totally changes the dynamics of two ongoing world conflicts when they arrive on the scene. So it always had interesting effects for us. You know, when the Rising happens in 1916, America hadn't yet entered the First World War, and people were able to kind of mobilize around the cause in America. You could come out in New York City and say, you know, I support the Irish Republic and I hope Germany wins the war, which was extraordinary.
Wow.
And American politics is always conscious of Ireland and Irish America within it. So just like in the First World War, when America enters the Second, it changes a whole host of things in terms of politics concerning us too. And they come in really out of nowhere. It's the immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor. Within weeks, they're here. Pearl Harbor is attacked on the 7th of December, 1941. By the 26th of January, we have American soldiers in Ulster, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And tens of thousands of these US troops are themselves of Irish blood, which is a dimension of the story that, you know, they're very conscious of. Uncle Sam is very conscious of how these young men representing the United States will feel in the land of their parents or their grandparents. So there's a lot of cultural sensitivities at play in all of this.
Yeah, and of course then not much time to really sort of approach all of those things either, because if you just decide effectively because of the events in Hawaii that you have to join the war straight away, you don't have a chance to really do some sort of like cultural drilling first to get these guys ready. And of course, Northern Ireland is also in this very weird position, because there's the fact that at one point in the course of this war, Winston Churchill is even open-minded to giving the North away.
Yeah, so what is Northern Ireland during World War II? Well, one, it's territory that we claim, because Articles 2 and 3 are still in the Constitution.
Yeah.
So, you know, as far as the Taoiseach in Dublin is concerned, he's the Taoiseach of all Ireland, all 32 counties. So it's kind of embarrassing for us when our great friend America begins landing its troops in Northern Ireland. It's very, very emotive. And, you know, as one historian has put it, Northern Ireland was a territory claimed by Dublin, held by London, governed by Unionists at Stormont, and rather ambiguously offered up by Churchill as a possible reward for Southern Ireland should it enter the war. I mean, Churchill puts this on the table with De Valera and essentially says, you know, what do you think, Dev? Now is your chance, now or never. a nation once again. Now that's now recognised as a bluff, of
Sorry,
course.
Even Churchill using the phrase, or even like even having the phrase "a nation once again" ascribed to Winston Churchill.
Isn't it brilliant?
No,
it may have been the 1940s equivalent of a drunken text or drunken tweet, which I suspect it was. But the fact that Churchill was even willing to play with this emotionally, you know, the idea of the fourth green field, a nation once again. So Northern Ireland is in this really, really peculiar place throughout the war.
Churchill saying a nation once again as well. But then again, I suppose, you remember like some of the speeches that were made, I'm getting on a little bit tangent here, but the speeches that were made at the end of World War II, where Churchill takes some time out of being like, you know, we've fought them down, we've stared them down, we've come through this great national moment of horror, and still takes some time to go, by the way, bloody Paddy's not getting involved. And then De Valera having to go back and be like, lads, we're not you. You need to get over it. Like, it's funny how even that hangs over the aftermath of such a terrible war as World War II was. So there were specific guidebooks drawn up for the Americans to try and help them get to speed with the people that they're now sitting in with. And sometimes these unintentionally become really, really funny.
Yeah, because as you just mentioned, I mean, this happens very quickly. You know, the attack on Pearl Harbor and then the immediate response of sending soldiers to Europe. It's very, very quick. So there isn't really time to do the great digging they'd like to do. But a number of guidebooks, these hastily assembled guidebooks, do survive. And they're basically designed to familiarize American soldiers with life in Britain and Northern Ireland. Mm. So a British guide says, the British don't know how to make a good cup of coffee. You don't know how to make a good cup of tea. It's an even swap.
Fair, yeah. You know, all right.
Conscious of each other's differences. But the stuff specifically around the north of Ireland is interesting. Although Irish girls are friendly, the old ideas still exist. You know, in other words, don't go too far, lads, while you're off. And the main point is, avoid politics, avoid religion. And as they say, argument for its own sake is a Scotch-Irish speciality, which is a great line, isn't it? You know? And arguing politics might be called a national sport.
Not wrong. Actually, that reminds me, actually, that guidebook, one of my school tours to Aramonch for like the site of the D-Day landings, I think they still sell replicas of the similar book that they gave to the Americans when they were landing in France. And some of what's in it now, when you think back, is just outrageous. Like, they're basically saying, these lads don't have the same sort of toiletries that you do, so they're all going to smell. Get over it. You know, they're not taking it personally. It's wild what you could write down. Behind the scenes in American politics, there is a little bit of unease and a bit of anxiety about what soldiers in Northern Ireland are actually going to be exposed to.
So the American Council in Belfast is writing to the American Embassy in Dublin throughout, and they paint a really interesting picture. There's this great line, you know, there's a disposition on the part of those who have religious and kinship ties with the Catholic population of Ireland to espouse the so-called Irish point of view. Some of our soldiers are susceptible to IRA influences. Now remember, when you're talking about American soldiers in the tens of thousands, you're talking about Italian Americans, Jewish American, Black American, but you know, there is a significant block for whom there's a worry amongst the Americans that these people could fall under the influence of kind of Irish nationalism in the north.
And then they'd become so nationalist that they end up then not really willing to fight alongside Britain in the war.
That's the fear. Right. That's the fear. And then we have these surviving letters from American GIs in the north that also paint a kind of interesting picture. One Black GI writes to the Northern Irish government about the difficulties they faced in some places. We are stationed near Antrim, located in the town. In visiting its establishments, we've been segregated. A friend and I visited Hall's Pub. They refused to serve us because we're coloured. We come to Ireland not because we wanted to, but because we wanted to do our part in this war. So just like extraordinary layers of stuff going on. The Americans are especially worried about the Irish-American troops, but Black American soldiers in Ulster, they seem to have a peculiar time of it, a strange time of it.
And one other thing then which is strange, aside from how exotic all of this might feel to some of the locals who then suddenly find themselves playing host to so many members of the American Armed Forces, that they do get their fair share of some of the old celebrity visits going over to try and entertain the troops, and even some of the generals whose names we still know today.
Yeah, it's a big part of the American Second World War experience, you know, if you're a soldier in Europe, building the morale, bringing over the big names. So they get, for example, Eisenhower visits them, Patton visits them, you know, heroes of the war, legendary generals, entertainers like Glenn Miller. Bob Hope is sent to Ulster to entertain the troops, which is just a mad thing to imagine, isn't it? Mm. And Eisenhower actually doubted the logic of sending the troops to the north. He said, we're going to regret every damn boat we send to Ireland. You know, he doesn't really see the logic of this initially in the war games of the continent, but eventually he comes around to it. And of course, these big names arriving into Ulster, they're embarrassing for Dev and the government in Dublin, who are claiming the north as their territory, because they bring a lot of American media. You know, a lot of American press picks up on these visits. But there's other stories that the American public never hear about. because of the weird nature of the Irish border. You know, it zigzags through Ulster.
Yeah.
Some counties in the Free State, others not. American soldiers do end up on the wrong side of the border on occasion. There's just wild stories of Americans wandering through, you know, the hills of Donegal drunk, seeking out public houses, being dropped at the border and kind of pushed across it.
Mm.
One soldier lands at Dublin Airport, one American. He's allowed refuel and then basically sent on his way. So we didn't really have any desire to intern wandering Americans as we do Germans over the course of the conflict.
Yes, because plenty of stories of the Germans who end up in the wrong place and then they're held there until we can find some orderly way to get rid of them. But if an American shows up, you're like, no, you're grand. You're going to go a few hundred miles up that way and you're grand.
You'll hit Newry.
A lot of the research around the GIs has focused then on their interactions, not with the society at large, but rather their interactions with women. And they take several forms.
Yeah, and there's been some great work done on this. Leanne McCormick, the historian, has written a lot on the relationships between these young American GIs and the local female population. And just some mad numbers come up in her work. Like, illegitimate births in Northern Ireland rise every year between 42 and 45. Prosecutions for prostitution, there was 10 in 1941 and 185 in 1943, right, which is just... absolutely.
A growth in the market, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's a funny observation, actually, in the letter home she found of one soldier on Irish dating. He said, "We're having a wonderful time. The people here are hospitable and I have a standing invitation at one very nice home. If I don't call on them in less than a week, they'll feel grieved. Yanks are a novelty, of course, and our welcome will probably wear out if we become too numerous. But by that time, I expect to have many friends with a few families. Mothers and grandmothers seem to be especially happy if an American soldier pays attention to an unmarried daughter. They say that if you go out with an Irish girl more than three times, you're practically engaged."
True. Yeah.
So I will have to watch my step. These are just brilliant little colourful memoirs.
And it's great to get like an outsider's view, just to have all of those little stories still surviving to this day. Ultimately, and maybe not just because they went out with dates three times and found themselves meeting the loves of their lives, some of these GIs' lives were arguably then forever changed by the time they had to spend in the North.
Yeah, and the American National War Museum, brilliant museum, tells us that over 60,000 British and another 100,800 Irish women married American servicemen, which is remarkable. Yeah. And these war brides, they were known. A lot of them went to the United States after the war and had children there, born from, you know, relationships created during the war. Mm. So that story, it's a really nice story. It's well told in the Northern Ireland War Memorial on Talbot Street in Belfast, great little museum. And, you know, that museum is so nice because it shifts the focus of how we understand the Second World War from the big picture politics, from Churchill and the war rooms, you know, and from military history like D-Day. Mm. There's something about everyday life. And that's what it was for these GIs. Yeah. It was a strange everyday life.
I'd love the idea that maybe they've gotten a Churchill impersonator. Maybe the one who showed up on GB News this week. Get him in and get him to do the Nation Once Again spiel. That would be that's a performance I want to see on GB News someday soon. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, just go Google it. It was a weird piece of television. Donald Fallon is the author of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, about the evolution of Dublin in the 20th century, and he is the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on the history of our capital city, which you'll find anywhere you get your audio online.
On the Record on News Talk,
brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.